Welcome to a new episode of the India Independent Films Podcast. This is Rahul Desai here, film critic for Film Companion. Sorry for being back so soon. I know you're sick of me, second podcast in a week, but it's always nice to have Uday Bhatia here, back after a while also. Film critic for Mint, of course, and it's just both of us today. Somehow me, Uday and Ishita don't seem to watch the same films most of the time, but... Yeah, we are going to be discussing two very interesting and actually good films this week. Both English language films, Hollywood films, if you want to call it that. It's also Valentine's Day, so it's only fair that Uday and me do it together on this podcast. And just in theme of the day, we are going to be discussing The Iron Claw, which is Sean Durkin's new film, which was famously snubbed by the Oscars, and it released in India last week. Great film, at least that's, and we will discuss that. It stars Zac Efron and Jeremy Allen White, amongst other actors. It's a wrestling biopic, and we are going to be discussing the much loved Holdovers, which is, of course, one of the surprise hits of last year. Alexander Payne's new film. It's, of course, it was technically a Christmas film, and a lot of people didn't expect it to be an Oscar favorite as well. Paul Giamatti, as usual, the star in that film. We will start with Iron Claw, and Uday just watched it recently. I reviewed Iron Claw, funnily enough, and Uday reviewed Holdovers, so between both of us, we have it covered, but we watched both films. So Uday, let's start with Iron Claw.
Yeah, for people confused, I reviewed Holdovers because I thought it was releasing last week with Iron Claw, and then it turned out it was not releasing. I had seen it before, so I did the release in the run-up, and then so it's releasing this week apparently, and Iron Claw, of course, already in theaters. Both worth watching in theaters. I think it's nice to see like non-blockbuster Hollywood release out here, because it's been patchy for those kind of films, especially since Iron Claw didn't really get much Oscar buzz. Maybe they thought it was going to, and then it didn't end up getting it, but they were releasing it around this time for that. Holdovers, of course, is quite well nominated, and Giamatti is a dark horse for the Oscars. So, yeah, so if that is more incentive, yes, definitely go see both films. So Iron Claw, it's about the Von Erich family, which was an actual professional wrestling family. Just before we start, it'll be, I think we'll get into some spoilers at some point.
Yeah.
And we'll try and give you a warning before it gets very spoilery. And I would also advise people who haven't seen the film not to read up on the thing. To just go see it, because it really takes some turns, and after some time things really start cooking. So basically it's the story of this one family where the senior Von Erich, who's played by Holt McCallany, whom you'll know from Mindhunter, plays Fritz Von Erich. He was a wrestler who used to mostly be the heel back in the day, and he didn't quite have the success that he wanted, and so he kind of raised his three sons to be wrestlers, and the fourth one is an Olympic athlete who also becomes a wrestler. The sons are played by Zac Efron, Jeremy Allen White, Harris Dickinson, and Stanley Simmons. And it's sort of, at first it's just the Zac Efron character, who's Kevin Von Erich, and the Harris Dickinson one, that's David. They are in Texas level wrestling. Like Texas has its own wrestling federation, and then they're part of that, and they fight in that, and they're trying to get to, you know, to a national level and sort of compete there and get like the, you know, the overall championship. And the Kevin, that played by Zac Efron, he's the most he seems to be the one who is on the best trajectory to achieve that. But as we find out, Fritz is a very manipulative father. He's a very demanding father, and he keeps pushing all his boys, and he keeps withholding his affections and changing his affections for them. At one point, fairly early on in the film, he does a ranking of which son is ahead in his affections, and then he tells them that this can change. And it's such a, I mean, that's just such an interesting and crazy thing to have. And it comes really early in the movie, and I kind of like, oh shit, okay. So this is like, they've absolutely laid out the movie for you right there. Like, it's this is how it's going to be. And yeah, and then it kind of goes on from there. Rahul, just a bit on Sean Durkin. I don't know if you saw his last film. I missed that, the Nest. But both of us really liked the one before that, which he made, which was Martha Macy May Marlene.
Yeah, it's been a while since Martha Macy May Marlene, like more than a decade. But yeah, that was his debut, I think, and of course, that's where he broke out, and great film, of course. I haven't watched The Nest. I think the Jude Law film, but yeah, I was meaning to watch it at some point, but that's why I was looking forward to, of course, Iron Claw, not just because of its subject matter, because Sean Durkin isn't as prolific as you'd imagine someone to be, broke out on the scene with the film like Martha Massey. It's only his third film in like 12 years.
Yeah.
Which is also a good sign, because Iron Claw looks very much like that kind of film that, you know, of course, I'd call it an anti-biopic of sorts, which I even ended up writing, but because it unfolds so much like a biopic, because it's part of the design, it's about a wrestling family. I was just curious, how familiar were you with, first of all, wrestling in your childhood, and secondly, the Von Erichs? Had you ever heard of them? Because there are some WWF figures that overlap with this film, like Ric Flair and a couple of others.
I just knew Ric Flair. Out of all the people that were mentioned in this, I hadn't heard of any of the others. I wasn't a huge wrestling fan. Just like, I mean, WWF was inescapable when we were growing up. So, I mean, to that extent, yeah, I watched a bit. But, you know, I think I kind of just dropped it after the, I think, you know, I used to watch it in the Bret Hart, that era, like, you know, and then it kind of, after that, I sort of didn't. So I didn't know about the Von Erich family and all. And very thankfully, like early on last year when the trailers dropped, some kind soul on Twitter, I think it said that, you know, if you haven't, the same warning that I gave people, that if you don't know about the family, don't read about it. And so I completely stayed away from reading. So I had no idea.
Yeah, fortunately, like, yeah, I was a big wrestling sort of buff in the 90s. I think from the Hulk Hogan era till well into the early 2000s, when Stone Cold and The Rock were at their peak or whatever. So yeah, like most of us, I think there's no escape from wrestling. And the golden era was the early 90s, late 80s. But I wasn't familiar with the Von Erich family, because this was mostly late 70s and 80s. This was, I mean, technically the first family of wrestling, and fortunately, I did not know anything about them. But it gave me a very fair idea of how sort of sporting families in this particular, which is, it's a simulated sport. It's not really a sport. It's entertainment, which is made to look like a sport. And it gave me a very good idea, because we were familiar with a lot of wrestling families in the 90s, like the Bret Hart one that you mentioned, you know, like one of them died, one of the brothers, Owen Hart, died in real life. And there were a couple of other families that I was always very curious about. Even Vince McMahon, who was the CEO of WWF, his entire family got involved with the as part of the script of wrestling over like more than a decade. And I was always curious about how much you can write into what's happening with the on-ring drama. How much you can sort of borrow from real life, or how, how they probably operate as a family. And what I found very fascinating about this film, at least the way it's written and the way it's approached by Durkin, is that it does not, even though it's very obvious that, you know, it's a medium of entertainment and there are scripts and the wrestling is fake and it's all sort of choreographed, it feels so much like a real sport because of the family in question, because of Fritz, because he wants his sons to quote-unquote succeed where he could not. It's almost like it's an Olympic sport or a football or something like football or something like tennis, where all the toxic dads sort of train their kids to sort of, they project their dreams on their kids and want them to succeed where they didn't. And your success is such a different, it has such a different meaning, because you're, the more talented you are, the more you can pull in crowds, the more favorable, you know, the scriptwriters are towards you within the entire wrestling ecosystem. So I found that family dynamic very interesting.
Yeah, because as you know, as you mentioned, it's often, most often that we get like the tough, but you know, in the end, the athlete or whoever they're training acknowledges that their toughness is what made them, you know, what they are, and that becomes like the end of the film. Out here it's just the film doesn't have that dichotomy. It's very clear that Fritz von Erich of this film at least is like a very toxic character, and toxic to the level almost like a psychotic edge, and his sons are all like, you know, scared of him, and they're generally like, considering the house that they've grown up, very repressed mother also, and they've turned out like they seem to be all fairly nice human beings, but it's just the hold that he has over them, the mount he pushes them, really kind of ruins them for life. And then on top of that, there's something that's introduced early on in the film, and then it kind of grows and grows through the film, that the idea that there is a curse on this family, like when Kevin is meeting his to-be girlfriend and then later wife, Pam, played by Lily James, he tells her about this curse. There's this, you know, that he had, like, they actually had a brother, a fifth brother, who died when he was very young. And the idea, you know, was that, you know, carrying on from, I think, his grandmother from that side down, there was a curse on the family, and that, you know, hadn't lifted. And then things happen in the film which sort of seems to perpetuate this idea. And it's very interesting, because it's really like sports biopics are mostly feel good. Like, it's just a feel good genre. That's where the whole thing gravitates. Even if they're really tough stories, they're generally like, you know, they're moving towards like a kind of catharsis, and like a happy catharsis. And out here, it is a relentlessly feel bad movie. Like, it is, it's difficult to steal like a few minutes of happiness from this movie before it kind of just keeps on landing you with more bad news, and just it's fairly tough to kind of go through. It really puts you through the ringer.
Now is a good time to say spoilers, in case it's not really spoilers, but you know, like, we're going to be revealing a few details about how the von Erich family story sort of unfolds throughout. I mean, the whole thing is that, like, as Uday mentioned, the von Erich curse, which I found very interesting that they introduced very early on. You have a religious mother, you have a father who's actually weaponizing that religion to convince his entire family, or his sons at least, that the curse is real. And so that they have it in there that the bad things that happen to them basically is not in their control. That it is, it's sort of a very weird happening of fate, or it's they are not in control of their own destiny. And that's one way of basically sort of, at least for the parents or the father of Riz, that for me, that was one way of the parents sort of just, escaping any complicity whatsoever in this toxic parenting, in the way they brought them up. And they don't want to take responsibility for how messed up their sons turn out to be. And we find that out because one by one, a couple of them start sort of disappearing or passing away. And it's a family full of tragedy. And I find it the most haunting part of the film for me was the way these things used to happen. There are a couple of suicides. There's a death because of a wrestling injury. There's because a son pushes himself too hard. It's basically five out of the six sons, at least in real life, died. And Kevin technically is the protagonist by default, or Zac Efron's character, because he's the one who is the hungriest in the beginning. You sense that he's the one who has inherited his father's dream the most, and he wants to be. He's probably the purest wrestler amongst them and the most ambitious. But the film is about how that ambition sort of, how once he starts his own family, once he falls in love, he starts to realize that that sort of claw that his father has over him may not be entirely because of the curse. It's the happenings. It's something that the parents or the father is responsible for. So I found it very interesting because the deaths that happen, we never see them. The one by one, the brothers just like, there's a sense that they passed away, but they just disappear. It's like a wrestling match itself. For those who have been fans of wrestling, it's impossible to not draw parallels to something like the Royal Rumble, where you know people just disappear from the script and there's one man left standing towards the end of it as the winner. And here, the only difference is that winner is not really the winner, and that's why we see Zac Efron's character as technically the central character of the film. So I found the design very interesting because they've designed it on the sport, on wrestling itself. They've designed the way people disappear from the script, the way people, the way sort of religion is used as a predetermined script of sorts by the parents to tell the sons that, you know, these things happen, but we will move forward. It's nobody's fault, but it is actually someone's fault. So they use fiction to sort of to escape their own culpabilities, which I found, for me, that was the most important part, or at least for me, the best part of the film.
You could definitely draw parallels to Foxcatcher with this film, because again, that's one of the few sporting films I think that has been released to in some kind of wide release that is a relentlessly sort of downer. Like it's just a tough film and very wrenching kind of thing to watch. And you had compared in your review Mark Ruffalo in Foxcatcher to Zac Efron out here. And Efron is absolutely amazing in this. Not an actor whom I've had much interest in the past, and but in this he's amazing in the way that he seems to, like, his character is absolutely like clear to you. I think like one or two scenes in, he's just absolutely nailed the character, and he knows exactly what it is, and it's he conveys it so well. It's not someone who can express himself very well, so words seem to sort of come out from him with a bit of difficulty. Someone who's obviously cares a lot for his family. Pam says, like in an early, in their first meeting, actually, that he has eldest brother syndrome, and it's there throughout the film. Like he's basically trying to take care of everything, and he's also trying to be a bit of a father figure in a family that very much lacks that. But his efforts, of course, are frustrated by his own father, who does not want things to be settled, and he wants that tension because he believes that that will kind of bring the results that he wants, which is that he wants a world title and he wants sporting glory in the house, and he doesn't care how how his sons achieve it, as long as they it's quite a remarkable performance. Did you sort of have any inkling about where this character and where it was going?
Not really, because I mean, as you mentioned, mostly because of how Efren plays it, he almost looks like someone who's not used to the body he has, and it's a big hulking body, and he moves around with almost like it's a burden on him, and that shows. And once he falls in love, once he gets married, once he sort of dares to have his own life, and mind you, he's the only brother who does that. And then he starts realizing that, it's almost like a human is trying to break out of him. But at the same time, Efren plays it, he's not used to expressing himself. He's only used to very binary emotions, as most wrestling stars tend to be in the ring. Like, even the father acts like he's always ringside, even when he's at home.
Yeah.
And they are brought up in that environment where everything sounds scripted, even though it's not.
Yeah.
And everyone seems to be performing in a way. And Efren plays Kevin in a way that Kevin stops performing after, or at least performs a little lesser than the others towards the end of the film. Once he starts waking up to the toxicity of his father, to the toxicity of what the family represents, even though they've given their whole life to wrestling, it's not exactly a feel-good story. It's not exactly about... I found it so... I mean, it was, for me, the biggest surprise was their build up to this title match with Ric Flair. And in any other biopic, that would have been, sort of a happy, sad ending where the son finally sort of wins and fulfills the family's obsessive dream, and you realize that too much sacrifice has gone into it. A lot of brothers have died for it. But here, you can almost see that Kevin is purposely trying to sort of cut loose of this family curse, which was wrestling itself. And props to Efren, because like, it's just such a challenging role to do. Like, I mean, fact that we are even comparing him to someone like Mark Ruffalo in Foxcatcher, which is a phenomenal film on its own, is something. And that's why I guess the fact that it was ignored by the Oscars is actually a mark of validation, because I think this film it's really difficult. As you said, it's a very challenging watch, but it is a very cleverly crafted film, and it is a very sort of, it goes so well hand in glove with the sport it's about.
I also just wanted to mention that Lily James out here, I thought was, I really did like that performance. It was a very warm performance, and she's basically the only one in the film with some feelings, or at least who has any way of sort of expressing her feelings in a helpful way. And I've not been the biggest Lily James fan previously, but I thought she was used really, really well in this film, and I thought she did a great job. It's a very likable performance, and it's tough to pitch those, because in a film where everyone else is repressed, if you're the only one who's not repressed, sometimes it seems like, you're trying too hard to be like sunny and positive and stuff. But I think she hits like a very believable note in that.
Yeah, and it never feels like she's playing the kind of vibe who's trying to yank him away from his toxic family. She's very much a part of that family.
Yeah.
And she's warm within that. And once or twice she mentions that it's your father's fault, it's not your fault, it's not the curse. Maybe you should blame your father. Only once or twice when he's grieving, when Kevin is grieving a death of another person. That's what Lily James brought to it. I mean, I've always, like, unlike you, I've always sort of liked her in most of the films she's done. But you're right that the character is also a very important character, because and it's a very far-fetched comparison that I even made in my review about Pam and Kevin, but it just very much reminded me of one of my favorite films ever, which is Truman Show. And technically, the sort of environment felt the same, where you're basically trying to pull out a man sort of falls in love, and he starts to realize there's more to his very pre-designed environment. There's more to the fact that he can actually break out of this environment because he's started to feel the agency of feeling again. So that's what it reminded me of in a very weird way towards the end of the film.
And just to add to that, what you'd mentioned before, the idea that everyone's always performing, like when they're supposedly off camera, they're always seem to be performing. And you can see that in, like, because like Kerry, that's Jeremy Allen White's thing, you know, when it finally seems like Kevin is going to get a shot at the title, but then suddenly the way Jeremy Allen White sort of suddenly speaks up as Kerry and says that, no, I'll do it. You know, I'm ready. Give me my shot. It's almost like, you know, like we see on TV in wrestling, you know, people saying, I'm ready, give me my shot and stuff like that. And it's that, but just in a slightly less dramatic context.
Is there anything else about Iron Claw?
No, nothing from me. No,
So for those who've obviously listened and who are looking for a very different sort of biopic to watch, and I also before we end, I wanted to ask you about one of the last scenes of the film. It's more of a sort of a surreal dreamish sequence, a heaven sequence, basically, where the brothers who actually passed away meet somewhere next to a river, they're brothers again. What did you think of that? Because it could have, I mean, it can be divisive. It sort of breaks the entire, sort of almost sentimentalist in a way. And you could easily edit that out and the film would be the same. I was just curious about whether you thought it disrupted the tone of the film.
No, tonally it is a little different. But I thought that was okay. I was all right with that scene. I did not like the one that followed it. Basically, the film's last scene, that one I did not like. The one with the kids.
The kids. I think the only thing I took away from the last scene was the fact that, you know, Kevin cries. That's it. Of course, it's very, like, it could have maybe been done in a less sentimental way. But I guess that was the point also, that, he should be in a different kind of film. And he was stuck in a very, very bleak film till now. The message gets driven home. And that's why the film, I think, will stay with me at least for a very long time. I'm glad I watched it. It goes very well with Foxcatcher, for those who are wondering. If you want to watch it, do a double bill and not come out like in need of therapy, please do watch it. We are going to move on to Holdovers. There's absolutely no segue to two very different films. Alexander Payne, as I mentioned, one of, I think, everyone's favorite actors, and the kind of actor that we don't realize is our favorite actor till we keep watching him on screen once in a while. He's also done this show called Billions, which we've been watching. Like, I watched it right when it came out. I lost track at some point, but I think Uday has discovered it also more recently. And I think very addictive show, Paul Giamatti. And when actors like him do like these multi-season network shows like Billions, you keep thinking, oh, are they wasting the talent? Are they just doing? But I think with Paul Giamatti, everything he does just feels like he was meant to do it. And I'm very glad he's getting the kind of attention he is for a rom-com. Technically, you'd call this a Christmas movie, not a rom-com. But it's so much more than that. And it's based in the 1970s, based in sort of a boarding school. Uday, a few lines about it before we move forward.
Yeah. Can I just say, I was very surprised to learn that you also liked Billions, because I just assumed that you'd think it was beneath you. And
you just projected. Like, this is the kind of thing you should
do. I have fairly trashy tastes in all these things, but you know, your slightly rarefied tastes, I thought you'd think that Billions a bit stupid, but I'm glad you enjoy it.
I see what you're doing here, but yeah, nice.
So yeah, Holdovers set in 1970, at the end of 1970. It's almost Christmas time. It's set in this sort of elite boarding school called Barton, which is in New England, not far from Boston. And Paul Giamatti plays Paul Hunnam, who is a history professor. I think he calls himself something else, but ancient studies, I think he calls it. And he's a very grumpy man. It's sort of, he likes the subject. You can feel his passion for you know, history and literature and things, but he obviously hates the students, and he and they are pampered sort of brats. It's a very expensive school, and they know that their parents will bail them out of any trouble that they're into, and because their parents are all like rich donors, so you know, they can get away with a lot. They don't really have to study, and their future is all secure no matter what grades they get, as long as they pass. And Paul Hunnam, he resents this. And so anyways, his life is carrying on. He's sort of, I think, resigned to basically being there his whole life. And we catch up to him just before Christmas. And a couple of students have to stay over instead of going home for the holidays for various reasons. Their parents are away, or they're too far, or something's going on at home, they can't have the kids home. And this is this happens every year, and every year someone from the staff is pulled in to babysit them. And this year it's Paul, and so there's a group of five students, and there's Paul, and there is one of the students is this sort of brash kid called Angus Tully, whose mom is remarried, so she's off on a honeymoon, and so he has to stay behind. And we already see him clash with his fellow students, and we can tell that he and Paul are going to be on a kind of collision course. And just rounding out this group, there is the cafeteria head, Mary, whose son also used to be in Barton and who died in Vietnam. So. Hmm.
How much did the way the film is designed, the way it looks, the aesthetics remind you of like Scent of a Woman or an actual sort of 80s, 90s film? Because obviously the choice was very deliberate too. It's one thing to sort of design your film saying, okay, we're going to look like the era it's based in. But yeah, it's another thing to actually pull it off like this.
So, I mean, it reminded me of I think it's set up to remind people of two things. One, of course, is the I very much Scent of a Woman. And I think it very much improves on Scent of a Woman, I liked a lot when I was much younger, and now I not so much. And I think Giamatti in this is much, much better than Pacino in that one.
What? And you what? You called me highbrow?
Yes. So, yeah. So, I think the second thing that this is sort of looking at, and again, you can see this through various hints in the film, is the films of the 70s, the new Hollywood films, not the Coppolas and the Scorseses and all, but the Altmans, the Mike Nichols, and the Hal Ashby films, the comedies and like the little dramas. Stuff like that, I think this film is also very much like has those on its mind, and you can see that in certain choices that it makes, like soundtrack and just the way characters are styled or the way they look, the way they speak. So, yeah.
I mean, technically, it's a fairly familiar story. We've seen this, as you mentioned, in a lot of films from not just the 70s, 80s, 90s, a lot of films, you see a sort of brash middle-aged man sort of having his own very unlikely coming-of-age journey through an experience like this, and it almost always involves a younger person. And here, of course, it's a bratty student, and I've been watching Alexander Payne's films for a long time, and I'm a big fan of most of them. And most of them we know involve road trips, we know involve like transformation journeys. Jamati himself has starred in Sideways, which was one of probably Payne's best films. There's been Nebraska, there was About Schmidt, there's a bunch of them, and we do tend to see the thematic similarities and all, but I think this film, the way it is sort of designed with these three characters stuck in a sort of in this holdover environment over Christmas together, almost feeling like basically three unwanted characters gravitating towards each other for whatever reason. I thought there's some sense of it's not that just that they're three anyone at all, because over the course of the film we learn a little about their backstories, and it makes total sense then, because we learn about Paul Giamatti's character Hanum, who is of course like this very sarcastic, caustic teacher who loves having a go at all these bratty students. And we learn that when he was a student himself, very promising student, he was framed by one of the richer students for a very serious offense. And he got suspended because of that. And that's technically the tragedy of his life. And he's been bitter ever since. So this is probably his way of getting back at the very same class bracket that had taken him down long back. And he got a second chance. He managed to become a small-time professor in this very, in this Barton Academy. And this is probably why he is the way he is. And the way we may call it a colorful movie character, but as a human being, he is very bitter. And he doesn't mind being the villain for a lot of these white students who've come on like very, very, who come from very, very rich families. His way of taking revenge in a way. And we learn also about Mary, who's the cafeteria manager, that she's, of course, African-American. Her her son who died in Vietnam, as Uday mentioned, is also, he was one of the few students, minority students on a scholarship there. And he was the one who had to go for service and not the other white students that are here. So because they sort of got into the academy. So for whatever reason, the rules of Vietnam were very different for colored Americans back then. And I think that's what makes it interesting, because both Paul and Mary have every reason to be absolutely hostile towards someone like Angus, because he belongs to that environment which they resent. At least which, you know, one, there's a grieving mother and there's a bitter old man, and they have every reason to sort of hate someone like Angus. And the fact that there's a sense of warmth and protection that they feel towards him despite who he is, and because he himself is a holdover like them, and he himself is sort of an odd one out even within that rich environment. I think that's the humanity of the film that everyone is talking about, that the sort of movie tropes are broken there. And, you know, Paul and Mary feel like, you know, almost makeshift parents towards someone like Angus. And they realize that not everyone can be held accountable for someone else's crimes. And you know, while they have every reason to feel bitter, I love the fact that it's Angus who sort of softens them.
Yeah. And it's Mary who's really pushing Paul to sort of be more empathetic, and she clearly, I mean, she's at one point she says, you know, don't fuck it up for the little asshole, and it's such a funny line, because, you know, she knows that he's a brat, and she knows that he's a, you know, that obviously he's getting on Paul's nerves, but even then she has that empathy, and especially as a grieving mother, you know, she sees a lonely kid, you know, who isn't wanted by his parents on Christmas, and you know, she just feels bad, and she pushes Paul to sort of be a better person, which is always fun with you know, with Paul Giamatti, because his natural tendency in his characters is to not be a better person, and then, you know, so it involves like a lot of complaining and stuff before he makes that that switch. The other kids, by the way, are sort of helicoptered off. It's a very funny sort of scenario. It's almost like Rushmore, those bits, because you know, a helicopter coming out of nowhere and then taking away these rich kids. And then, you know, even the Angus Paul dynamic for a while kind of looks like it might just be Rushmore, with this sort of escalating series of battles between them. But things really change once, you know, Angus has a bit of an accident, and then Paul has to take him to get patched up in the hospital. And then they don't really bond, but things start, you know, they at least have to kind of acknowledge each other as human beings, and sort of talk to each other and understand each other's predicaments. And things kind of progress from there, and they become, they become something like a family. It is a very warm film. And if you've seen Sideways all those years ago, you can tell that this is the work of perhaps the same filmmaker and actor, but like older and wiser and a little kinder. It's not that bleakly funny. It's sort of, it has a lot more hope.
What did you think about, like, sort of Paul being the de facto protagonist of the film? Because, I mean, for a while, it obviously looked like a bunch of students stuck in, you know, school over the holidays. And then very funnily, they get helicoptered off and it's just three of them left. Like, it's just one student left. And of course, by, you know, like, it's almost like saying that, I mean, you expect that the younger student is technically the protagonist of the film, but it becomes mostly about the adult who falls sort of trying to make peace with his own past and getting closure for who he is and becoming a better person, as you said, after years of bitterness. And I always find it interesting when there are more than one character and there is one protagonist. And of course, it's Paul Giamatti, so, you know, you don't think too much about it. But it is about his transformation more than everyone else.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I like that it's sort of, it gives, like, not only, it's Paul's is the central tale. I think through that, we mostly see things through his eyes, not so much Angus, not so much Mary, but even then it finds like these Angus finding time to go and visit his biological father. You know, you have that scene. You have Mary finally visiting her sister and her husband, and just being with her own family, and that's a really nice, sweet little scene. Mm. And so you see them away from each other also, and he just gives enough to kind of give us a sense of their, you know, their broader lives, so that we don't just see them in context of each other also. And therefore, when they kind of come back together, it becomes even richer, I think. It is a chamber piece, but it feels a little, it doesn't feel constricted because of these like little hints. Like, you get hints of Paul's life before that also, an old classmate bumps into him, and you have that exchange. So you keep getting these sort of hints of a broader universe, rather than just what is unfolding out here. And it's a very, it's also a very sort of beautiful recreation of that time and place. There's a party scene, which is one of my favorites.
I was just going to say that it's one of my favorite scenes of the film.
Yes, so good. And I love that there's a minor character in this who plays like the cleaner, who's actually probably the fourth person who's held over, and the actor that's really, really actor playing that's really good. I think Naheem Garcia, I think, seems to be his name. Fantastic, cameo out there, couple of scenes, wonderful presence. He turns up at the party, also gives Mary a gift, and it's really nice.
It's just the right amount of feel goodness, also, right? Like, you know that, I mean, you know that, okay, Paul's going to break free of his past, you know that, like, he's going to rescue the kid before he goes, he's going to save his future, and then you wonder about Mary. What does she have to look forward to after this? Her son is not there. She was a single mother. Now she's just like a woman who's grieving the death of the only person she loved. And then that's where that sort of janitor comes into the fore in a very, very small way. It's not like the film is making any grand statements about the fact that he really likes Mary or he wants to be part of her life. But these little small gestures give you just about enough hope to know that all three of them will be fine after the film.
Yeah, it's and like little nods to, I think, 70s film of that time. There is this film called Harold and Maude, which has a Cat Stevens soundtrack. And out here, they use one Cat Stevens song called The Wind. And I think that's probably pointing to that. And the guy who comes and threatens him in the bar, not really threatens him, but he feels like he's threatening because he has a hook for a hand. That guy really looks a lot like Elliot Gould from that time, especially in the Altman films, MASH and all. And MASH had come out that year. So like a lot of things really reminiscent of the cinema of that time. It's like nice little nods out there. Where do you think this fits in the we're going to go on about Jim Atty a little more. Where would you see this as? Do you see this sort of as like a culmination of a lot of the characters that he's played? Like, would you say that this is this a recognizable Jim Atty type? This character?
I mean, it's very much sort of validation for the kind of actor he's been over the years. He's done a bunch of trashy films. He's done he's always stood out even in the bad films. He's a very prolific actor. He does a lot of television, not just films. So, you know, you always fear that someone of his stature, his talent, is getting sort of chewed up by this system of just wanting to do something or the other. But he's always been there. And I remember when I watched him back in 2006, I think, in Shyamalan's bomb, Lady in the Water, which got a lot of flack. But I kind of like that film because it's very much a children's fable. And it has Jim Atty in that. And I remember people talking of him then as sort of a very unlikely Oscar nominee. But the film didn't do well. So it went under the radar. No, it got no awards love at all. But even in that, he plays a janitor of a complex of sorts, and very much someone, a very reluctant protagonist, again, lives alone, is a loner, is sort of a very crabby loser. And I like that Jim Atty's arc has always followed that kind of, as you said, you know, he's always playing someone, you know, who sort of not exactly transforms through a film or through a narrative, through a TV show, but there's so much that he plays characters that they want to be so cynical about the world around them, and to see someone like him get the kind of not just the recognition, but the film that actually platforms his strengths, which is basically being able to see some good in the world after a lot of bitterness. I think that's a good thing because he's done too many films to even seek a pattern. But if you see him on screen for at least two scenes, you'll know exactly the kind of actor he is and the kind of characters he plays. And every great actor of a generation has a perfect director for them. I think Payne and Jim Atty are that couple. That compatibility is there between them.
Yeah, and he's always... He has so many down vibe characters like people who are, you know, either just like sort of given up on life or who are just misanthropes or who keep getting defeated and just cannot seem to win or get in their own way, just, you know, even billions, he cannot seem to, even when he wins, he can't rest. And because he can't rest and because he can't like go that extra mile to sort of put axe away, his own career just keeps getting cut short. It's interesting to see him get this role also, because as you said, it's kind of like validation. It's almost like a reward of just all those years of hard work that you get this kind of, you know, the Pacino in Scent of a Woman, or, you know, the Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting role. And then, you know, you latch on to that. And I think he does that out here, but it's a really good film. So he doesn't have to go into any kind of crazy sentimentality or anything. I think he can just do his thing and be funny and be honest, and it turns out very well. And both Sessa and Divine Joy Randolph are excellent in the other two leads. I think Dominic Sessa is the first time I'm seeing him. I don't know if he's really appeared in anything else.
It's his first film, I think.
Oh, wow. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, he has such a great face.
Yeah,
like,
he does.
it's like you could, you could picture him in with directors across eras, and the face suits. Like, I could see him in a Michael Mann film, could see him in an Andy Warhol film, could see him like in a Hal Ashby film. He has all the faces for all those kinds of films. It's just, it's very, very impressive.
He has a very Lucas Hedges sort of presence, face, energy. You know, of course, very promising, talented young actor. And it just very much reminded me of the sort of kid who can easily play sort of a school bully in one of the films, and he can play someone vulnerable like this, who's sort of a jerk who's coming of age, a brat who's coming of age. So yeah, you're right. Like, it's amazing that it's probably his first film, and it is just the, I can imagine the directors lining up. I think for me also, another thing about Jamati is that his self-seriousness is played as a comic device so often, and I really like that. Like, he knows he's such a self-serious actor, and he has so many quirks, and he has so many we love watching people sort of mimic him. And
that guy who did it at the awards function, that guy was brilliant. Anyways,
and it's so funny that it's very rare that such a sort of an actor like him can turn that into more of a joke within his films. And he knows that, you know, his characters are looked at as buffoons because of that most of the time, or people who take themselves too seriously, people who act like they're better than others, like in this film, he's a professor. So, he derives great pleasure out of that. And it's not often, because you see most actors trying to sort of distance themselves from their gravity. But this guy does it very well, and he's always done it. And it's so ironic that he'll be up against a very, very serious role for the Oscar in Oppenheimer, and which is the absolute, like, that's what I talk about, like, when I'm saying, like, the pensiveness about a role, about how seriously you take yourself. And it'll be very interesting to see that, even though I don't care.
Interesting to see how it turns out also, because these are exactly the two kinds of roles that get awarded at the Oscar, like the big important biopic, American hero slash tragedy kind of role, or like the person who has a change of heart and who's like the character actor who's been like finally getting the role of a lifetime kind of thing. And then they love to award both those types. So it's a test of the Oscar's own kind of conscience also, where they're going to go on this. Just a small word about Randolph also, who is really funny in whatever she turns up in. And it even when she's really funny, you kind of figured that she'd be a very good dramatic actress, and out here she is. But I saw her in The Lost City, which is this. The Sandra Bullock Channing Tatum film is, I thought, is hilarious. And she's really funny in that, and she's really good on Only Murders in the Building. Really good in that awful train wreck of a show called The Idol. She's really funny, but this is the first time I've seen her like in a proper dramatic role, and she's excellent in this.
She's had quite a year because she's in Rustin as well, and there's another Oscar nominated film. I haven't seen it, but I see her filmography right now, and quite a year, and she's a front runner to win supporting actress, which is, for those who are interested in the Oscars this year, she is there is no other contender as far as she's won everything till now. So for Holdovers, so it'll be nice. I haven't seen too much of Only Murders in the Building, so I don't really have a reference as such, but Lost City I remember very well.
Anything else on
not really, but except this it's kind of, I'd admit, it's kind of a surprise that this is being talked about so much, especially during award season. I know you said that, you know, like Jamatis is the kind of role that the Academy likes to award and stuff like that. But a film like this, you because it's labeled as a Christmas film, or it happens during Christmas, you tend to not look at it through the lens of, say, you'd look at something like Sideways, or which was also a favorite during award season. So I'm quite happy to see this like in discourse and all, because when I was looking for a Christmas film in December to watch, and we've probably watched every other sappy Christmas film that's ever made, I immediately watched this, and I was like, this is exactly the kind of film I was looking for. But then if you look beyond that little period in December, there's so much more to this film, and that warmth is some very much a part of, I think, what you need from, you know, the world right now, apart from your serious biopics, apart from your you know, your legacy productions. So it's nice to see also Payne back in action after a long time, and it's of course always nice to see Jamati. That's I think that's about it for the Holdovers. For those of you interested, as we mentioned, it's releasing this week in cinemas, hopefully, because it's supposed to release last week in Indian cinemas, I mean. So do catch it if you can. It'll be a lovely time at the movies, as will Iron Claw, very different kind of time at the movies. It's playing in theaters as we speak. Apart from that, I think we'll be back later this month, couple of other big releases. Till then, thank you for listening. Take care, and write into us if you have any suggestions.